Hey there. Welcome to Queen's Law Pro Bono Radio. I'm your host, Andre Uzumtoma, and I'm a first-year law student here at Queen's Faculty of Law. Queen's Pro Bono Radio discusses interesting and off-center legal topics that aim to make legal discussions more accessible to you, the general public. We strive to stimulate interest and provide information while always being entertaining. This week's show explores the evolving landscape of Canadian drug laws, specifically as they relate to psychedelics, which are better known as magic mushrooms or simply shrooms. Before I start, I want to clarify that the views expressed on the show do not necessarily reflect the views of the producers, hosts, or the Queen's University Faculty of Law. This podcast does not contain any legal advice. PBSC is a student organization. This podcast was prepared with the assistance of PBSC Queen's Law student volunteers. PBSC student volunteers like myself are not lawyers, so I'm not authorized to provide you, the listeners, with any legal advice. These episodes contain a general discussion of topical legal issues. So if you require specific psychedelic legal advice, get off this podcast and speak to a lawyer. Let's dive right into it. So, why this topic for this week's episode? Well, it all started with a conversation I had with a friend last fall. We were walking through downtown Toronto when we passed a shop openly selling magic mushrooms. Neither of us said anything and just kept walking though. A few blocks later, however, we turned a corner and came face to face with yet another magic mushroom storefront. My friend looked at me and said, "Wait, I didn't realize shrooms were legal." "I don't think they are," I replied. "Well, aren't you the law student?" he quipped. I had to concede. I actually wasn't sure. And that got me thinking. If I, as a law student, didn't fully understand what was going on with these stores, how many other Canadians were just as confused? How are magic mushroom shops openly operating across the country when psilocybin is presumably illegal? That's what I set out to uncover. And more importantly, that's what I want to share with you today. Let's start with a psychedelics 101 introduction. Psychedelics are known for their ability to shake up consciousness, altering perception, thoughts, and mood in ways that can be deeply transformative and profound for some. The classic psychedelics include LSD, mescaline, and psilocybin, which is the main psychoactive compound in magic mushrooms and the key player behind all the cultural buzz, controversy, and curiosity surrounding them. Then you've got the quote-unquote atypicals, things like MDMA and ketamine, which don't fit neatly into the classic category. Some of these substances, like psilocybin and mescaline, have been used for centuries in indigenous ceremonies for healing and spiritual exploration, whereas others, like LSD, are lab-made in the 20th century. Now, here's where things get interesting. Psychedelics don't work like most drugs. While each one has its own effects on perception and emotions, the experience itself can vary widely from person to person. Trips can last minutes to hours, and for some, the after effects can linger for days, weeks, or even years. The exact science behind these experiences? Still kind of a mystery. One reason psychedelics are being explored for therapy and healing is their impact on neuroplasticity. Basically, they help the brain rewire itself, making it easier to break old thought patterns and form new ones. This can be especially important for people dealing with severe medical conditions, perhaps in tandem with the emotional weight of facing death. Psychedelics can potentially offer a way to ease suffering or reset the mind when nothing else seems to work. Now, are psychedelics safe? Well, compared to most other psychoactive substances, they're considered low risk and non-addictive, except for ketamine, which is a bit of an outlier. But let's be real, they're certainly not risk-free. A trip can turn into panic, anxiety, or reckless behavior, and in rare cases, long-term psychological effects like psychosis or visual disturbances can stick around. That's why most clinical trials exclude people with conditions like schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, or heart issues. It's simply just too risky. What's even less understood is how often these risks actually happen in real-world use. Lately, researchers and advocates have been pushing back against psychedelic hype, gathering reports of bad trips and negative experiences to make sure we're having a balanced conversation about their potential and their pitfalls as well. So, whether you're curious, cautious, or all in on the psychedelic renaissance, one thing's for sure. These substances are not only reshaping conversations around consciousness and therapy, but they're also challenging the legal frameworks that govern them. But where exactly does the law stand on psychedelics like psilocybin? Let's break that down next. The Controlled Drugs and Substances Act is the federal statute governing the legality of psychedelics in Canada. Under Section 4 of this act, it's illegal to possess a substance listed in Schedules 1, 2, or 3, unless authorized by regulation. We'll get into that later, though. Psilocybin is classified as a Schedule 3 substance, meaning unauthorized possession is a criminal offense. Let's discuss criminal offenses, because they fall into two categories: summary conviction and indictable offenses. In simple terms, a summary conviction is for less serious crimes and usually comes with lower fines and shorter jail time. An indictable offense, however, is for more serious crimes, carrying heavier penalties and longer prison sentences. This distinction is important when looking at the differing legal consequences. For example, the punishment for a summary conviction for possession of psychedelics is a fine of up to $1,000 and or imprisonment for up to 6 months for a first offense. A repeat offense can lead to a fine of up to $2,000 and or imprisonment for up to 1 year. However, if charged as an indictable offense, possession of psychedelics carries a maximum penalty of up to 3 years in prison. Before I proceed with more sentencing ranges for the various offenses dealing with psychedelics, I just want to offer the disclaimer and clarify that all the following sentences and penalties discussed throughout this podcast are taken directly from the Controlled Drugs and Substances Act and the Criminal Code. And they don't necessarily represent all possible penalties or sentencing ranges. So, if you're facing charges under the Controlled Drugs and Substances Act, please consult a lawyer. Okay, let's turn our focus to Section 5 of the Controlled Drugs and Substances Act, which prohibits the trafficking of psychedelics. Trafficking includes selling, giving, and transporting controlled substances. If convicted summarily, the maximum penalty for trafficking psychedelics is up to 18 months in prison. If prosecuted as an indictable offense, the sentence can be as high as 10 years. Similarly, Section 6 of the Act, which governs the import and export of psychedelics, and Section 7, which regulates their production and cultivation, also carry a potential 10-year prison sentence for those convicted under these provisions, Sections 6 and 7. Despite these strict laws and punishments, psychedelics dispensaries are opening across Canada at surprising rates. So, at this point, you might be wondering, if all these legal barriers exist, how are businesses like the ones we encountered still operating in broad daylight? Well, if this sounds familiar, it's because we've seen a similar story before with cannabis. Before cannabis was legalized in 2018, unlicensed cannabis dispensaries began appearing in major Canadian cities, openly selling products that were still technically illegal. Law enforcement responses varied, with some cities cracking down while others turned a blind eye, allowing the market to grow. The same fragmented approach is now unfolding with psilocybin dispensaries. In Vancouver, police have largely ignored them, while in cities like Toronto, there have been sporadic raids, including notable seizures in 2023. But in the past year, enforcement has softened, much like what happened with cannabis in its final years of prohibition. This has allowed the underground psychedelic market to expand rapidly. Many psilocybin dispensaries are modeled after early cannabis shops, offering everything from dried mushrooms to microdosing kits in sleek, consumer-friendly packaging. By operating openly, they're effectively challenging local authorities to shut them down. And for now, many law enforcement agencies seem hesitant to fully engage. The uncertainty around enforcement has sparked mixed reactions. Some advocates see these dispensaries as a way to normalize psychedelics and accelerate legalization. Others worry that their unregulated presence could backfire, making lawmakers more resistant to change. The disparity in enforcement might also be explained by what some call a form of psychedelic exceptionalism, which is the idea that authorities view psychedelics as relatively low risk compared to the ongoing crisis surrounding opioids and other more hard drugs. Psilocybin advocates argue that the path forward should mirror cannabis legalization. Before legalization, cannabis was first permitted for medical use, eventually leading to broader access. Advocates suggest a similar model for psilocybin, where patients could either grow their own, designate a caregiver to grow for them, or obtain it through regulated suppliers. This is where psychedelic litigation becomes critical. Courts have played a major role in shaping drug policy in Canada, particularly in medical cannabis cases. And now, a similar battle is unfolding for psilocybin. The constitutional right to individualized medical psilocybin access is currently being tested in the Canadian courts through the 2022 Hartle lawsuit. This case could determine whether patients have a fundamental right to access psilocybin for medical use, challenging the existing legal barriers that have made it nearly impossible to obtain. In July 2022, 8 plaintiffs, including patients and healthcare professionals, filed a lawsuit against the Ministry of Health challenging the prohibition of psilocybin. Psilocybin medical exemptions are technically allowed in Canada, but in practice, the plaintiffs in Hartle in Canada argue that the system is so restrictive and unreliable that it effectively denies them access. At the moment, there are two paths individuals can take to receive medical exemptions. First, doctors can apply through the Special Access Program, or SAP, to get psilocybin for patients with serious or life-threatening conditions. Or second, patients can apply for a Section 56 exemption under the Controlled Drugs and Substances Act to use psilocybin for medical purposes. It's worth noting that the Section 56 exception is also used to allow researchers and universities to legally study psychedelics. For example, the University of Toronto has been exempted to conduct clinical trials using psilocybin and analyze the drug's effect and potential for medical applications. The problem is that these two exceptions are unreliable and hard to obtain. Health Canada has stopped granting Section 56 exemptions for ongoing medical use, rejecting nearly all new applications since March 2021. Meanwhile, SAP approvals are highly restrictive, mainly used for emergency cases and involve high costs, often forcing patients to travel long distances to receive care. Thus, the plaintiffs in the Hartle lawsuit claim that patients face long delays, inconsistent approvals, and a lack of clarity on how to get approved. The Hartle lawsuit includes testimony from terminal cancer patients experiencing debilitating end-of-life distress, individuals with PTSD and anxiety disorders who have exhausted all other treatment options, and psychotherapists who need psilocybin training to provide effective treatment but are denied access. Thus, practitioners and patients alike are forced to suffer without treatment, or choose from treatment options that do not work and are only left with the option of medical assistance in dying, or in the worst case, resort to illegally obtaining psilocybin because the legal system has failed them. Ultimately, practitioners and patients need more options, and medical psilocybin regulations like these ones used for cannabis might help give them that other option they're looking for. Having said all this, the plaintiffs in Hartl claim that Health Canada's refusal to grant reliable access to psilocybin violates Section 7 of the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, which guarantees the right to life, liberty, and security of the person. Let's unpack this alleged Section 7 violation. Denying access restricts one's right to life, liberty, and security by causing unnecessary suffering and, in some case, worsening mental health. The current system puts health decisions in the hands of the government instead of the doctors, inherently forcing patients in an undue state-imposed burden. The bottom line is that Hartl is trying to get at is that medical exceptions for psilocybin exist on paper, but in reality, they're almost impossible to obtain. So, what's the end goal of the Hartl lawsuit? Well, the plaintiffs are asking for a court declaration that Canada's psilocybin laws are unconstitutional. They want permanent constitutional exemptions allowing patients to legally possess and grow psilocybin, and they want exemptions allowing health professionals to use psilocybin for training. Ultimately, they are hoping for a shift from the government as a gatekeeper to a system where doctors determine patient access, like with prescription drugs. But while much of the conversation around psychedelics focuses on their therapeutic potential, their use also raises significant questions in criminal law. Next, I want to discuss the 2022 case of the Crown and Brown, which highlights how psychedelic use intersects with criminal liability and how cases like this have influenced amendments to Canada's criminal code. In January 2018, Matthew Brown consumed alcohol and mushrooms at a party in Calgary. Experiencing a psychotic episode, he left the party, broke into a woman's home, and assaulted her, causing severe permanent injuries. Brown claimed he was in a state of extreme intoxication or automatism, arguing that he committed the crime without conscious awareness or voluntary intention. Brown challenged the constitutionality of Section 33.1 of the Criminal Code, which barred the defense of extreme self-induced intoxication leading to automatism. And he was successful in doing so. The Supreme Court ruled that Section 33.1 was unconstitutional because it automatically imposed criminal liability. However, the case also sparked public concern, particularly about the potential for people to take psychedelics, commit violence, and then claim a lack of intent to escape criminal liability. So, Parliament rewrote Section 33.1 to allow the defense only if the accused can prove they did not negligently act in consuming the intoxicant. So, what does the new Section 33.1 mean for current psychedelic cases? The law now takes a case-by-case approach when someone tries to use the extreme intoxication defense. Courts will ask, was it objectively foreseeable that taking a large dose of psychedelics could lead to a state where the person lost control? Did they take any steps to avoid that risk, like limiting their dose or staying in a safe environment? Were they aware that substances like psilocybin or LSD can trigger hallucinations, paranoia, or even violent outbursts? This new standard makes it much harder to claim extreme intoxication as a defense, even with psychedelics, which are generally considered non-violent drugs. Judges will look at key factors like how much the person took. Was it a controlled microdose or an overwhelming amount likely to cause psychosis? They'll also consider the person's individual tolerance and past experiences. For example, did they understand what they were getting into? And finally, was the intoxication truly extreme? We're talking about a complete loss of control and awareness, not just a bad trip. And this part further requires medical evidence and expert testimony. In short, simply saying, "I was too high to know what I was doing," won't cut it. The law now asks, should you have known better before taking the drug in the first place? Lastly, I want us to turn back to the Control of Drugs and Substances Act and highlight Section 4.1, which I think is very important for listeners to know about. Section 4.1 of the Control of Drugs and Substances Act provides protection for individuals involved in a medical emergency caused by psychedelics. Legally, a medical emergency refers to a life-threatening event triggered by a psychedelic substance where emergency medical or law enforcement assistance is reasonably necessary. Section 4.1 holds that if someone seeks emergency assistance for themselves or another person during a medical emergency, they cannot be charged if the evidence supporting the charge was obtained because they sought help or remained at the scene. This protection applies to others present at the scene when emergency personnel arrive, including the person experiencing the medical emergency, of course. The law encourages individuals to seek life-saving assistance for themselves or others during emergencies. It removes the hesitancy in calling for help and the fear of prosecution, thereby prioritizing saving lives over criminal penalties. All right, we've come to the end of this episode, so let's bring it all together. Psychedelics, particularly psilocybin, are at a fascinating crossroads in Canada. On one hand, they're still illegal under the Control Drugs and Substances Act, which we've spoken about at length, with harsh penalties for possession, trafficking, production, cultivation, and distribution. On the other hand, dispensaries are popping up across the country. Enforcement is inconsistent, and legal challenges like the Hartle case are pushing for change. If history tells us anything, it's that the law doesn't always keep pace with cultural and scientific shifts. We saw this with cannabis, where underground markets thrived and legal battles chipped away at prohibition until full legalization became inevitable. Psychedelics seem to be following a similar trajectory, but whether they'll reach the same outcome and how long it will take is still up in the air. So, what's the big takeaway? First, the legal landscape around psychedelics is evolving, but for now, psilocybin remains illegal unless you have a rare exemption. Second, the growing presence of mushroom dispensaries is testing the limit of law enforcement and public tolerance, much like early cannabis shops did. And finally, courts could play a major role in determining whether psilocybin becomes more accessible, especially for medical use. Whether you're fascinated by the science, interested in the policy debates, or just wondering why there's suddenly a shroom shop on every corner, one thing is clear. This is a legal conversation that's far from over. Thanks for tuning in.
If you are tired of the algorithm-based music age we are in and looking for unique, boundary-pushing new sounds, join me, Luke, and oftentimes friends on The Grove every Tuesday at 3. We will listen to and discuss music from electronic to alternative. See you there.
You can't handle me. Hold up. Ain't you Nathaniel B?
What is it?
Get the
Tune in at Wednesdays at 2 p.m. from the program. I, your host Nate, will go over a variety of different genres and themes. I sometimes call my friends and do dumb stuff, and if you guys like dumb stuff, you're gonna love my show. So yeah, Wednesdays, 2, be there.
Good morning, and welcome to Queen's Law Pro Bono Radio. I am your host, Michelle Cernak. Queen's Law Pro Bono Radio discusses interesting and off-center legal topics that aim to make legal discussions more accessible to you. We strive to stimulate interest and provide information while always being entertaining. This week's show is on animal law. Before we start the show, we would like to say that the views expressed on the show do not necessarily reflect the views of the producers, host, or the Queen's University Faculty of Law. This podcast does not contain any legal advice. Pro Bono Students Canada is a student organization. This podcast was prepared with the assistance of PBSC Queen's Law student volunteers. PBSC students are not lawyers and they are not authorized to provide legal advice. The podcast contains general discussion of certain legal and related issues. If you require legal advice, please consult with a lawyer. In today's day and age, animals play an increasingly significant role in the lives of many families, with nearly 80% of households owning at least one pet, according to Statista. Whether as companions, livestock, or for scientific purposes, the legal status and rights of animals have become a growing topic of discussion among scholars and legal professionals. Historically, animals have been classified as personal property, a framework that fails to reflect the deep social and emotional bonds that they provide to a vast number of people. Recently, some Canadian courts have issued innovative decisions that move away from this traditional property-based approach, recognizing the complex relationships between animals and their human companions. While these rulings represent a shift toward better legal protections, they remain groundbreaking and not yet widely adopted. This raises important questions about how animals are currently protected and treated under Ontario law, and what legal challenges and changes may be on the horizon. Joining us now in the studio to discuss the rapidly emerging field of animal law is Lori Graham. Lori is an associate at Lundy Levieski Baum, where she maintains a busy commercial litigation practice and professional liability practice. In addition to her firm's work, Lori provides litigation services to individuals that are facing legal challenges involving their pets. A dedicated advocate, Lori has represented clients before all levels of Ontario courts and various administrative tribunals as well. Her passion for animal law stems from a lifelong involvement in the equestrian industry. Lori grew up on a family farm that bred and raised horses, and she has also been a competitive rider and a strong advocate for animal welfare throughout her life. During her legal studies at the University of Toronto, Lori was heavily involved in pro bono work, a commitment that she proudly continues today. Lori, I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Lori, I'm going to begin with my first question, if that's okay.
Yeah.
Perfect. As previously mentioned, animal law is a rapidly emerging field with broad-ranging effects. In your opinion, Lori, when did you first start noticing an increase in litigation involving animals? And in what areas of law are animals most commonly impacted in Canada?
Yeah, so I think we've had sort of a steady state for a very long time in terms of animals cropping up in sort of your property disputes. And you have your sort of dedicated subset of animal statutes that are specifically dealing with animal welfare and things like that. But the biggest uptick in numbers, I would say, has been probably in the last sort of 8 to 10-ish years. That's when you've started to see sort of the pet custody legislation start to take hold, first in the U.S., and now you're starting to see it in at least one province in Canada. And so as we've moved more towards seeing animals as pets and members of our family in that sort of last decade, I think you've really started to see a lot more litigation involving animals, and also a lot more complicated, complex, and maybe interesting litigation involving animals. In terms of what, you know, areas of law you see them cropping up, all over. So lots of contract disputes of all different sorts. So buying and selling and all of the things that can go wrong in that process. Payment disputes of all kinds. Ownership disputes, and then in terms of tort law, you're going to see all kinds of different professional negligence and occupier's liability claims where people are getting hurt, animals are getting hurt on private property, people are having issues with their care providers, their veterinarians, things like that. So you'll see all kinds of claims there. And then again, you'll see in the family law context, you'll start seeing custody disputes and things like that. And that's in addition to, yeah, things like, you know, animal welfare statute and the like. So kind of all over, and maybe more places than you would expect.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, Lori. I guess that kind of leads me to my next question. Pets are now considered more as part of the family for many people. And these disputes that you're mentioning seem to be increasingly showing up in family law cases as well. How do courts typically handle these disputes, and what are the common legal remedies?
Yeah, so for a long time, and really in Ontario, still to this day, pets are treated as property. So it's no different than a car, a radio, a laptop, PS5. and so there's something to be divided if there's a dispute, and if they can't be divided, then they are to be sold and the money is to be divided. So that's the sort of traditional treatment of them. They don't really get imbued with any kind of emotions. They don't have, in either way, pets towards us or us towards pets. So very different than what you would think of as, you know, when you think of children and that sort of thing. But now, yeah, you're starting to see a shift starting in BC last year, really, where the pets are being treated not, they're still treated as property, but they are treated sort of as a different kind of property, where the courts are starting to look, take a more thoughtful, nuanced approach to what role pets play in our family and how important the bonds that we develop with them are, and trying to be a little more thoughtful about how things like custody and care are determined and the like, instead of just looking at sort of the dollars and cents that you would in a traditional property dispute.
Mm-hmm. And I know, Lori, you've mentioned BC taking some more progressive steps in this area of law. That kind of leads me into my next question about the approach that the courts have taken, which we refer to as the relational approach. Can you explain what this means and how it works in practice?
Yeah, so unfortunately, it's not how it works in my practice in Ontario, but early last year, so early 2024 in BC, you have a reform to their Family Law Act there. And it changes the way, like I said, that the courts handle disputes with certain animals. So not all animals, but certainly those that fall into the category of pets. So it doesn't include things like agricultural animals and the like, but certainly for your sort of household pets. And so what that does is it basically acknowledges, yes, pets are property, so they're not children, but they are special and they have special bonds with them. And so, you know, when you're trying to make an order in the family law context to deal with a family pet, they've come up with a new set of factors that they want to consider when they're making those determinations. And they are, you know, like I said, more alive to the bonds that animals and their owners have. So you're looking at, you know, what's the relationship between the companion animal and the, is there any risk of violence towards the pet from anybody? What's sort of their history with the pet? Is there any threat of cruelty? Who's caring for the animal in practice? And that doesn't just mean who's paying the bills, you know, who's paying the vet bills, so to speak, but who's actually in the home caring for them? And who's going to really be able to meet the needs of that animal on an ongoing basis? So, you know, compare that to sort of the traditional approach, something like we would see in Ontario. It's not in, you know, it's not necessarily as different as you might think, but it's, the focus is different. It's much more on, okay, well, who bought the animal? Who paid for them? Who's paying for the bills? Whose name is on the paperwork? That sort of thing. And so much less on the kind of bond that's formed and the attitude towards the animal. So yeah, in BC, they've adopted this new approach towards pets and pets in custody cases that lets them take sort of less tangible, less financial factors into consideration when they're dealing with these disputes over pets.
Mm-hmm. Well, and Lori, do you see these positive steps influencing the courts in Ontario?
Yeah. So, I mean, on the one hand, we haven't really seen the courts in Ontario embrace the approach that we've seen in BC, but I will say it's very new, especially in court time. Less than 2 years is definitely in infancy as far as the courts are concerned. And, you know, generally the way it goes is no one wants to go first. So the fact that BC has taken that first step and now other provinces will have some case law that they can look to, and they can kind of look at the statutes in BC and see how they've been implemented and what's working and what's not, that I think will go a long way in giving the other provinces comfort if they then want to move in a similar direction. And as lawyers, again, you have case law that you can rely on. Case law out of province isn't going to be, you know, binding, but it is persuasive. So you can certainly rely on it and make your pitch. And then all it takes is, you know, you get one judge on side and then you get a decision in province, and then you've got something to build on. So I think we'll get there, but we haven't really seen it formally embraced yet.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, you did refer to the fact that this is very novel. And we know that courts tend to be quite conservative with novel ideas. Leading into perhaps the downsides of courts implementing something like what BC is doing and treating pets more like children, do you see any problems with that progression?
Yeah. So, I mean, on the one hand, it means there is a lot more for the court to consider, or that a court can consider in terms of the evidence and the record and the relationships that are at stake. But in practical effect, that also means you're asking the courts and lawyers to do a lot more work, which can involve a lot more money and a lot more time. And these are, you know, if you're litigating, you know, care and control of an animal, presumably there are emotions that are running very high. So although the court on the one hand is saying we want to look at other things besides who's paying the bills for these animals, you know, the more protracted litigation becomes, the more you just have a structural advantage in favor of the person who can last the longest and spend the most. So, you know, it's you're able to spend lots of time and money litigating these concerns now, but that doesn't necessarily always redound to the benefit of who we might like. So there's that. You also get into, you know, you're asking judges in the court to, you know, take on a role that they aren't as accustomed to having. Courts are very good at dollars and cents. They're very good at property disputes. They're very good at contract disputes. They're not inherently that great at things like evaluating relationships and the like. So there's a lot of judicial discretion there. And so there's a lot more room for varied decisions, which, depending on which way it goes, can be good or bad, depending on your perspective.
Mm-hmm.
But so yeah, there's risk there, and there's certainly a lot more resources that can be utilized and used and abused depending on the case.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, Lori. So I guess moving from that more general thought process, I'd like to ask you more about your particular expertise in equine litigation. Mm-hmm. What are some of the most common legal disputes involving horses, and how do these cases differ from the disputes over household pets like we were just discussing?
Yeah, so household pets, typically the parties are going to be the owners. So whoever is in the household, couples that are splitting up and the like. Some sort of shared ownership or shared custody that breaks down, and then you're trying to mediate that. Horses, you know, oftentimes horses are boarded at public boarding stables. So then you're going to have a lot more disputes involving sort of the owner of the boarding stable or other borders at this table amongst themselves. You're going to have, you know, more interactions with things like trainers, vets, haulers, farriers, all those kinds of things. So you have lots more points of friction with outside parties who don't have an ownership stake in the animal. I can say, I think confidently, I was a long-time equestrian. You also have a lot more expenses that are involved in typical day-to-day equine ownership. So a lot more payment disputes and the like. So you, and, you know, also often have contracts of some degree of sophistication that are, you know, ostensibly guiding those relationships that need to be interpreted and the like. So you see a lot more kind of third party disputes that are not just about ownership or custody, but are dealing with these sort of outside entities that also have a stake in keeping horses in kind of today's society.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's interesting that the equine industry encompasses such important third-party arrangements that a lot of people don't necessarily think that they require legal advice when forming a lot of these contracts. And the more involved you get in the equine industry, you really realize there's a lot of liability involved that I think people aren't really familiar with.
There's a ton of liability. First of all, I would say, as a general observation, the equine world has, I suspect you can relate, the level of contract drafting that you encounter regularly in the equine world is not great. It's usually some form of either my insurance company gave it to me and I never looked at it, or I Googled X contract and this was the first one that came up.
The boilerplate.
Maybe it was from Canada, usually not. And that's what we use, or we copied and pasted 7 different versions and we forgot to get anybody to sign it. That's pretty scary. Which you would never see in a commercial dispute. You have contracts that are negotiated with lawyers on both sides and this back and forth. Yeah, almost never in the horse world. So you have contracts that the courts want to put a lot of emphasis on because they like contracts, because they tell them how to interpret the relationship, but also they are often a mess. So there's a lot of room for dispute. There's a lot of room for litigation. And the other piece of that people, I think, don't often appreciate until they're really in it is at the bottom of almost all of those interactions, vets, boarding stables, barriers, all of that is insurance. So a lot of, almost everybody has some form of liability insurance that can respond in one way or another. But knowing how to access that insurance and how it impacts the sort of obligations that each party has is a bit of a trick.
Yeah, no kidding. I mean, I know from experience, a lot of these agreements, like you said, are copy and pasted from Google search engines. And, getting more familiar with contract law myself, you really start to realize the contradictions in a lot of these agreements that if push came to shove, I mean, I don't really think that they would be permitted in the court. Or I don't really know how they would actually be able to justify a decision on these, filings.
Yeah, I mean, even if they're even coherent enough to be interpreted in a consistent way, insurance companies are probably the biggest driving force in terms of introducing contracts into the equine world. They have a practice now of sort of like providing waivers, providing contracts for their insureds and saying, use these or otherwise we won't give you coverage. The problem with that is, if you are just giving it to a party who hasn't read it, doesn't understand it, and they're having somebody else sign it, hopefully, who doesn't read it and can't understand it, and also couldn't change it if they wanted to, it's going to be a tough contract to uphold in court.
Yeah. Well, on that note, Lori, I want to talk to you more about neglect cases. in the equine industry. And I want to talk to you about how they're usually handled, particularly because I know that they encompass a lot of outdated legal tools, like the Innkeepers Act. And I know that these tools sometimes fail to prioritize the welfare of the animals.
Yeah.
And so that leads me into asking, you know, what kind of legal changes or approaches do you think could help ensure that more effective and humane resolutions for high-risk animals are brought on?
Yeah. So for those that don't know quickly, the Innkeepers Act is essentially a very old statute, if the name didn't tip you off, that allows someone who's running a public boarding stable basically place a lien on a horse if there is a bill that's unpaid, and there are certain notice provisions and the like. And the eventual result of that is that in order to get that bill paid, you could have a public auction for the horse, sell it off, and, you know, put whatever proceeds towards the bill and give the excess to the former owner. So that exists. It's a mechanism in place essentially to, you know, provide a payment solution for boarding stables in a pinch. And it really does reflect horses as property, right? If you have property and you can't pay your bill, same way that you can lean a condo or something like that, you sell it and you use the money to pay the bills. A lot of issues with that in terms of putting it in action. You also don't see it used very often because public auction is a terrible way to sell horses of any value. So it's not perfect for sure. I would say generally there's a huge area of opportunity here for people who are interested in contract drafting, are interested in alternative dispute resolution, really taking advantage of the fact that there's not a lot of governing doctrine in this area, but there are a lot of people who would love to have better negotiated agreements that have, quicker and more responsive ways to respond to non-payment issues, to respond to issues where care is, you know, substandard, and allow for some form of private dispute resolution that doesn't necessarily require either something like a public auction or, frankly, going to court. Because, you know, the reality in Ontario is that it can take several years to get to court for the first time after, you know, you are commencing a lawsuit. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of time and space there for creative drafting and for people who have the talent for mediation and the like to do a lot of good work both for their human clients and the horses that are at stake.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, and you know, taking into account the concerns that you've brought up about the timeline and, you know, how long this process can take, who really becomes responsible for the care of those horses while they're in this dispute?
So, I mean, in practice, you will see, you know, and again, this is kind of more characteristic of the horse industry than necessarily the legal industry. But, you know, you'll see barn owners who are carrying huge tabs for these horses that will, you know, that care about them, and then they're not going to stop providing care. But they will end up, you know, incurring huge tabs at their own expense. And on the other hand, right, they don't want to relinquish control of the animals, say, like, okay, it's your problem, you feed it from now on, because if they do, then their lien right is affected because liens require sale, and you can't sell something that you've already let go down the road. Mm-hmm. So it, you know, it cascades in a way that is really problematic in an industry that's not, I don't think anyone would describe as particularly lucrative. And it puts people in really difficult situations. And yeah, that's when you start seeing the sort of, well, we put them out in the field, we threw them out back, we gave them whatever hay we had left because we can't afford to house and feed them the way that we might otherwise if the bill was paid. And so it's not a good situation for anybody. But you find, you know, the horse industry in a lot of ways still works the way it worked 100 years ago. And people are very slow to change, and there's a lot of implicit trust in those relationships, and not always for the best of anybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it goes without saying that I'm hopeful that we're going to come to better conclusions with the emergence of animal law taking more of a role, I would say, in today's society. And though it's being more focused on pets, I'm really hoping it starts infiltrating into the agricultural industry as well.
Yeah, and like I said, there's a ton of work to be had there. Really and truly, there are lots of clients who, especially like I said, not as you know, I work more on the litigation side, which is after things have gone wrong, somebody has to get sued, and we have to sort it all out. But there's a ton of work on the preventative side as well, in terms of drafting agreements that avoid these situations. It can be done. It just hasn't gotten a lot of attention in the past. But I find that the clients are very eager. They would love to have somebody to sit down with to help them, you know, sort of get agreements and policies and procedures in place that will protect them and the horses that they care about.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, Laura, you just touched upon, you know, your practice in litigation. And so that leads me into my question about what advice you might give to aspiring lawyers, such as myself, who want to specialize in animal law.
Yeah, I would say there's no one path to animal law. As you can kind of tell from talking about it, animal law touches on a lot of different areas of law, and it touches on a lot of areas that you will study in law school, whether, you know, just in the core curriculum, contract, property, estate planning, family law, you're going to see all of those things. So learn those sort of black letter areas of law, and you can go work in private practice or wherever you want, and just, you don't have to start with animal law cases. You can start in commercial disputes, or you can work for the government. You just need to learn how the system works and how the law works in practice. And then when you get, you know, a little more comfortable and a little bit more on your feet, then you can start to reach out to, you know, people who you know and your connections who have animal-specific questions. And, you know, your job is to really help guide them through the legal system, which then you have the expertise to do. So, you know, it's just because, don't feel like just because you did an article in an animal law job, of which there are probably two articling positions in Canada, that it would be considered animal law proper, doesn't mean that you're out of it or you're at a disadvantage. It's really a matter of being able to translate your black letter law, to owners and sort of the language of animal ownership. So that's what you sort of have to practice. But like I said, to start out, there's no magic to it. Just start where you can and learn sort of contract, property, family law, and then translate that into, you know, the specific clientele that you want to serve.
Mm-hmm. Great. That's such great advice, Lori. Thank you. And I guess I'm going to ask you one final question. And that's with regard to if there are any concerns or interests that we have yet to bring up in our discussion today in terms of animal law that you think are important to mention still.
You know, I think just more to this last piece in terms of translating the law and applying it to these animal relationships. The other piece of that is going the other direction. The other skill is being able to translate your love of animals, those bonds that you have, those astronomical costs that you've incurred that make total sense in your mind because you love your animal, being able to translate that to a court, to a judge, And that's a real skill. And it takes time. Don't overlook, I would say, in that area of law, the importance of relying on experts. And so if you're in private practice, you're developing your skill set, being able to use, being comfortable with using experts to provide opinions on your cases, on standard of care and the like, is really important. And so as you're out in the world, you're thinking about, you know, as you're forming relationships with vets and barn owners and other trainers and things like that, coaches, you know, how, you know, can these people serve as experts for me in the future in a way that can help explain to a judge sitting in downtown Toronto who doesn't own a goldfish why it made a total sense that you spent $50,000 in vet bills on a horse that is probably worth, you know, 10 tenths of that on a good day. So there's lots of, again, that's just like the translation goes both ways. If you're translating the law to the animal owners, but also translating animal ownership to the courts and to judges. So that's the, you have to kind of hone your communication skills both ways.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Great. Yeah, Lori, I mean, you completely understand the finite implications of horse ownership and bubble wrapping injury-prone critters. And unfortunately, like you said, it's a field that I don't think a lot of people can understand the cents and the dollar ratios unless they're really immersed in it. So I'm definitely going to keep that in mind.
It makes sense to us. Even as owners, maybe it doesn't, but
it's like, yeah, you said, the emotions sometimes, you know, they guide us in the way that might not be logical, but makes sense to us in the moment.
Well, Lori, thank you so much again for taking the time out of your day to come and discuss some of these issues with regards to animal law with us at PBSC and at Queen's Law. I think we've taken up enough of your time, but I just want to say that it has been extremely delightful to listen and to hear to your point of view regarding these issues. And once again, I just want to say thank you very much for joining us today on Queen's Law Pro Bono Radio. And to all the listeners out there, thank you all for tuning in. I hope that this was an insightful podcast. Today's show was produced by me, Michelle Cernak. I am also your host. If you liked this interview, you could find more on the Queen's Pro Bono Radio website.
Broadcasting 24/7, 365, you're listening to 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca, Kingston's only campus community radio station. Tune in for the best local programming.
Awesome Kingston is Kingston's micro-grant organization. We've given away over $125,000 in micro-grants over our 12 years. We meet 10 times a year to hear pitches from our community, and every time, we give one person or group $1,000 cash, no strings attached, to help fund their dreams. If you have an idea that might make Kingston more awesome, consider a pitch to Awesome Kingston to win one of our $1,000 no strings attached micro grants. You can pitch at awesomekingston.org. Proposals are due the first Sunday of every month, and selected pitches are heard the third Thursday of every month. Once again, pitch your awesome ideas at awesomekingston.org.
The Corridor is an award-winning news program hosted by Dinah Jansen and Jesse Bell, airing every Thursday at 5 p.m. on CFRC 101.9 FM. With contributions from local Journalism Initiative reporters ranging from Morrisburg to Coburg, The Corridor is your premier destination for truly local news that matters to you. The Corridor is also available as a podcast on all major podcast streaming platforms.
If you are tired of the algorithm-based music age we are in and looking for unique, boundary-pushing new sounds, join me, Luke, and oftentimes friends on The Grove every Tuesday at 3. We will listen to and discuss music from electronic to alternative. See you there.
Broadcasting 24/7, 365, you're listening to 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca, Kingston's only campus community radio station. Tune in for the best local programming.
It's 3 o'clock. You're listening to CFRC